Rotliff and Mr. Kelliter, whenever you're ready, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Trey Kelliter. I represent Chris Drotliff in this matter. I'm here today. I would like to address the issue of the involuntary manslaughter instruction. My colleague, Mr. Dash, representing Mr. Cannon, would like to be able to address the court on the issues of MEJA and the false exculpatory evidence instruction. So I'd like to focus on the involuntary manslaughter instruction. In that regard, we're asking that the court reverse and dismiss in this matter because the trial court made two fundamental errors. First, the court erred in giving the instruction at all by, I think, misapprehending the legal principle of what constitutes deadly or non-deadly force, and which gives rise to whether or not it becomes a jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter. And the court factually misapplied that standard to the case at hand. And then secondly, even in giving the instruction, the court worded it in a manner impermissibly that created a situation where the jury actually found beyond a reasonable doubt that these two men engaged in legal self-defense, in that they met both prongs of legal justifiable self-defense and yet still ended up committing a crime.
How do we know that?
Well, it's because
we don't have special interrogatories here. We don't have any idea what the jury...
Well, Your Honor, the jury instructions on JA 1070...
I understand the instruction, but all we have is a general verdict.
Well, Your Honor, the way the instruction is worded, it says on 1073 and 1074 on involuntary manslaughter, you must find...
Start on 1072. That's really where the story starts.
Yes, Your Honor, starting with the self-defense instruction.
Yes, it does, and it talks about the notion that excessive force can... you can assert self-defense, but you don't get it if you use excessive force.
Absolutely.
And then the court picks up on 1074... And your suggestion is because he used the word self-defense, and that's an absolute defense, that you couldn't have excessiveness. But the court did instruct that a self-defense defense can be lost by excessive force.
Well, that's what...
Excessive force can.
We agree that that's what the court intended, but
that's not what the court said.
No, that's not... Well, what the court said is, to make it clear...
Force likely to cause death or great bodily harm is justified in self-defense only if the person genuinely believes that such force is necessary to prevent death or great bodily harm to oneself or others. This is an objective test. And then the court goes on to explain how you can use more force than is objectively reasonable.
And we understand that.
The court goes over and says, in involuntary manslaughter, a person who is privileged to use self-defense who does not intend to use deadly force may nonetheless commit involuntary manslaughter if he fails to use due caution and circumspection in his defense, resulting in the death of another.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, I don't see how the jury would get to the wrong conclusion in those instructions.
Your Honor, this is, again, assuming that he should have given the instruction in the first
place.
All
right, you can address that if you wish.
Right, well, I'll get to that, but then also, directly on this point, we agree that what the court was trying to get at was imperfect self-defense. And we agree that if you fail to meet those two prongs, then in a case where involuntary manslaughter can be given, then yes, you can be found guilty. The problem is, I was reading on 1074, it notes that you must find the essential elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And on line 17, 4 is the death charged occurred while the defendant was committing a lawful act, that is self-defense. So to first find that, you first have to find the prong that they met the elements of self-defense. And the elements of self-defense, as Your Honor noted, are on 1071, where it explains that justifiable self-defense is a genuine and objective belief followed by essentially a proportionate response. What happened here is they essentially said, the instruction says you first must find beyond a reasonable doubt that you met both prongs of quote, self-defense, and then say that that can be trumped by a failure to exercise due caution and circumspection. The court on 1134 defined due caution and circumspection to include the notion of consideration before acting. Well, that's not an element of self-defense. What essentially, what the court asked the jury to do was first find that you had a genuine...
Why isn't consideration before acting broad enough to encompass, if you're going to use automatic weapons, military-grade weapons, to fire at a fleeing vehicle, and you really want to stop the vehicle, but not kill the people inside the vehicle, why isn't that broad enough to encompass that? Because that's what happened here, right?
Right.
Taking your client's evidence in the light most favorable to your client, what happened here is, as I understand the record, these gentlemen wished to stop the vehicle. They had no interest in killing anybody.
Correct.
According to the defense.
Right.
They simply wanted to stop the vehicle.
Right.
And the way they chose to stop the vehicle was to discharge their automatic weapons.
Well, I would address it in two ways.
And according to your defense, as I understand it, they made a mistake. They discharged their weapons at the wrong angle.
Correct. Your Honor,
why is that encompassed by due consideration?
Well, Your Honor, two reasons. Number one, and I will get to the second. The first reason is we're looking at what the legal standard is. And I don't doubt that when one looks to the totality of whether or not somebody has acted reasonably in self-defense, one thing you might think about is did they think about it? Was there consideration before acting? But that's not the standard. What I would submit that in most cases of self-defense, if you take an example of self-defense involving a handgun, it is very common that somebody reacts in the moment to a situation without thinking. And they'll take the witness stand and say, I shot him because I was scared and I saw a gun flashing or I saw something and
right.
I shot.
Normally
and,
one doesn't exercise self-defense against the fleeing vehicle.
Oh, my point is this, is that in instructing the jury first had to find legal self-defense and then could find that because they didn't think about it long enough, because they didn't engage in consideration before acting, that made it involuntary manslaughter. Our concern on that point is that in giving the instruction and wording it this way, it essentially makes involuntary manslaughter the one offense that even though you meet the legal standard of legal self-defense, you can still be found guilty of a crime.
If you use excessive force.
If you use excessive force.
Objectively excessive force.
But
what the jury apparently found. Because
well,
they got a self-defense.
Well, no, Your Honor.
Instruction, and you, I must say, if you read continuously from 1071 all the way over through 1074, you get a picture of a very accurate statement of the interplay between self-defense, excessive force, and involuntary.
Your Honor, I would note that the hook that would allow them to trump legal self-defense is the last sentence of the instruction that says, but by failing to exercise due caution and circumspection. Essentially, the government's argument
That's the elements of involuntary manslaughter.
Well, but they're essentially also saying that those are the same elements of excessive force. That
I think
on element
you're
four,
going to ignore all the language on 1071. I mean, we take these.
Right.
You can't say everything in one sentence. You have to say them one after the other.
Well,
that's the way language is.
As we pointed out, if essentially the court had said that while defending themselves, that is, engaging in the act which they claim is legal self-defense, they did this, then that would be a proper instruction. But when you tell the jury...
I'm not sure how else a person who speaks English well would take these instructions as a whole.
Well, Your Honor...
It looks to me like they came to a pretty circumspect verdict in this case.
Your Honor, even more importantly, as I noted, he never should have given the instruction.
That's really your main complaint, isn't it?
Well, that essentially...
You didn't for anything want involuntary manslaughter in this case.
Well, and Your Honor, in this case, I think the government, the trial court, and the defense all agreed on the basic cases that control the law. And the law basically says if you engage in non-deadly force, then either the government or the defense can ask for the instruction. But if it's deadly force or if it's wanton disregard, then you don't get the instruction. And the government points out correctly that it goes both ways. that if the government wants it in this case, the government is essentially saying that in any case...
Well, deadly force, you mean intent.
No. The case law makes clear that deadly force has two possible prongs. You intend to kill, or that you acted in a manner where it was likely that you would kill. Because, again...
But the facts in this case allowed for the possibility that they did not intend to kill.
Oh, they said they didn't intend to kill. But as we cited the Model Penal Code, Black's Law Dictionary, the Fifth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit, they all make, and the cases that the government relies upon, Manuel out of the Ninth Circuit, they all say that if it's deadly force, if you either intended to kill or if your actions were so wanton that there was a likelihood, substantial likelihood of death. And of course, when you use an AK-47 on a tight intersection in the dark, firing it at an occupied vehicle, that is deadly force.
Depends on how good your aim is.
No, the very nature of firing an automatic weapon at a vehicle, at an occupied vehicle, is deadly force.
What if you fired them at the tires?
At a vehicle, yes. At an occupied vehicle, absolutely. And the cases we cite, Gutierrez out of the Fifth Circuit and Bradley out of the Seventh Circuit, they point out that using a deadly weapon in self-defense is, as I think the Fifth Circuit says, the paradigmatic example of deadly force.
Yeah, I think you'd have a really strong case if the government hadn't asked for this instruction and the judge just sort of popped up and did it on the judge's own.
The government didn't ask for this
well,
instruction.
Well, they did. The judge said, do you want it? And the government said, oh, yeah, judge. Well, no, absolutely, we want it.
Judge, that's the same thing.
It's not the same thing. Well, it is not the same thing.
As Your Honor, as we pointed out, that we had to submit jury instructions ahead of time. And the government submitted a voluntary manslaughter instruction at 4:30, and I think the record was at 4:30 one evening after the end of the evidence. Judge Dumas, for the first time, said, "I'm going to give involuntary." Well, then of course
he said, "Do you want it?"
Oh, no, Your Honor, he said, "No." He said, "I'm going to give it." He said, "I'm going to give it."
Didn't he say, "I'm going to give it if you want it"?
No, he said. I want to tell you I'm planning...
How about showing... I'll read this together.
I'm sorry. JA 849. On JA 849, starting at line 12, the court says, you may be seated. First, I'll tell you, I'll see you all tomorrow at 8:30. But I want to tell you I'm planning on giving an instruction on voluntary manslaughter and involuntary. The basis for this, and then he gives four pages of why he's going to give it, all the way up to 852, and then there's discussion with defense counsel. I don't think... Oh, and then actually on 855, this is where the first time the government pipes up, at line 2 on 855, the government says, well, just to make sure I understood, you're giving voluntary and involuntary. And the court says, I'm going to start with second degree, then voluntary, then involuntary. And I still don't see where he's asked Mr. Salisbury for it.
Well, I don't want you to expend your time. I'm sure the government will point it out to us. I seem to recall the record indicates pretty clearly that the government acquiesced in the court.
But as I pointed out, the judge brought it up at the first time on 849, and goes on for pages and pages before the government jumps in. But my concern is this, in terms of just giving the instruction. The government is essentially putting forth a standard that so long as a defendant in a shooting case says, quote, or it doesn't have to be a shooting case, says, I didn't mean to kill them, then either party then is entitled to an involuntary manslaughter instruction. Because if they claim they didn't mean to kill, I mean, if somebody detonates a building and blows up 100 people.
I don't have any doubt that any district judge in America would give an involuntary manslaughter instruction if the defendant puts in a self-defense defense and supports it by evidence.
Well,
of course you get it.
Well, not if your sole evidence is to say, I didn't mean to kill him.
Why not?
You'd get a voluntary manslaughter.
The jury could believe that.
Well, no, but that's not the standard. The standard, as we cite...
So we're back around to your earlier argument.
Well, I would note that
do circumspection. Exercise caution and
the cases we cite make it clear that on the issue of do you get the instruction, does it become a jury issue? It's not simply whether or not you intended to kill. It's whether you were intended to kill or you knew it was likely or should have known it was likely that somebody would be killed or could be killed.
And that's a jury question.
Well, I would submit that if you follow the Fifth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit that make it clear that using a handgun in self-defense is the paradigmatic example of deadly force, when you then say it's not just a handgun, it's an AK-47 military-grade weapon firing at an occupied vehicle. Now, granted, they say we didn't try to kill him, but the point is you're firing at a vehicle within 10 feet within a small intersection.
I think we've gone through. You guys have.
Your Honor, my time is up. If I may.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Dash?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I am Larry Dash. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I did represent, along with Mr. Broccoletti, Mr. Cannon at the trial level. Mr. Kelleher indicated that I would talk about Mejia as well as the false exculpatory statement. Quite frankly, the Mejia issue, we understand and we acknowledge the Brehm case. So clearly, we'll stand on our briefs on that unless the court has any questions. But I do want to talk about the false exculpatory statements. And in this particular situation, the trial court, to compound the errors that we believe were made that Mr. Kelleher just talked to you about, the court erred in giving the instruction altogether on false exculpatory statements. And then when he tweaked the standard instruction and left out the aspect of when an individual has been notified of a criminal investigation and just left it as an investigation, then that information can be used to imply that a person has consciousness of guilt. In this case, our clients gave three statements in advance before there was any acknowledgement that there was a criminal investigation. They gave one statement to their employer the night of the incident. A couple of days later, they gave another statement to their employer, and then they gave a statement to an AR-15-6 investigator, Colonel Nicklock. Now, in each one of those situations, the testimony at JA 543, 544 regarding the employers it actually begins at 513. The statements were taken by the employers to facilitate, coordinate, and cooperate with any of the local authorities in the country to find out what the totality of the situation was. And they were looking at policy violations. They weren't looking at criminal acts. And then a few days later, when they talked to Colonel Nicola, who was the appointed officer, by his direct testimony that the government elicited, it was not a criminal investigation. It was an administrative investigation in nature. It was informal, non-judicial, just to determine the facts of the incident. And quite frankly, what they did was they used that information then to pay the individuals' families that were killed and or injured to justify payments by both Blackwater USA as well as the Army. Now, we obviously objected to this instruction at the instruction conference, and our whole hang-up was that they had not been notified of a criminal investigation until days later, and when they were first interviewed by a special agent with the Army CID, Special Agent Rodriguez, which the government chose not to put that statement into evidence at all. They made a conscious decision not to include that statement, but that was the first time that they were notified that it was a criminal investigation. And clearly, we believe that the case law is consistent, and we've cited approximately 50-some cases as well as three treatises that all talk about you have to have the word criminal in there.
Why is it reversible error, even assuming it was erroneous?
Well, again, when you take the totality of the jury instructions and you look at all of the jury instructions, the judge erred as a matter of law in this particular case.
But why is it reversible error?
Well, in this case, it harmed. It did, in fact, harm the defendants, both Mr. Cannon and Mr. Drotliff. In the closing arguments and rebuttal arguments, actually, of the government highlighted that particular instruction.
You don't deny that the statements were admissible.
We don't deny that the statements were admissible.
So the statements are coming in,
The statements are
coming in. Your objection is to the court's permission to the jury to consider it as circumstantial evidence, consciousness of guilt.
As a matter of law, that when the judge says...
I guess what I'm trying to get you to address, the same argument could have been made even had the instruction not been given.
That correct? I believe that is
the
true.
The evidence would have been admitted.
Yes.
And so how does, if that's true and you agree it's true, it's clearly true, how does simply giving the instruction elevate this to reversible error, given the record as a whole?
Because now the judge has, in addition to the other instructions, he's now put additional weight that the jury should give. And basically said, this is a matter of law. You must follow my instructions. Although there are, and I see my time is about up, there are some indications that he said, you're free to ignore my instructions. But the reality is judges give instructions, and everybody knows that it's the law that they must follow. And when a judge gives the law that must be followed, then that creates the reversible error.
Thank you.
Mr.
Salisbury.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to introduce seated with me at counsel table, Randy Stoker, my colleague. The two of us were co-counsel at the trial of this case. Responding to...
Mr. Salisbury, if we can just clarify this one thing, what I was referring to in my colloquy with counsel was on page 922 of the joint appendix.
That's correct.
Okay. And the judge says, I won't give it if you don't want it. And you said, oh, I want it.
That's right.
Okay. And that was about the involuntary manslaughter.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. The problem with the defense argument in this case that the instruction should not have been given and that the evidence would not support involuntary manslaughter is that they want it both ways. They want to say the killing was accidental, but since firearms were used, as a matter of law, that's deadly force, and therefore a jury can't find involuntary manslaughter. That's not the law. The law was correctly set down by Judge Dumas. And in this case, there was ample evidence in the record for the jury to give credence to the defendant's statements that they were only shooting to disable the sedan, but nonetheless to find that in discharging their firearms, some 30 rounds, including an AK-47, at a fleeing vehicle, dark at night, that they did so in a criminally negligent manner. And there's nothing incompatible with the self-defense instruction and the involuntary manslaughter instruction. In fact, the cases that the government cites in its brief, the Ninth Circuit cases in Manuel and Crow, the Tenth Circuit in Brown, make it amply clear that self-defense and involuntary manslaughter are not mutually exclusive. In fact, this is very similar, in a sense, to the Tenth Circuit's decision in Crow. In Crow, the defendant stated she intentionally stabbed the victim, intentionally, but not to kill him, but not to kill him. Somewhat similar to what we have here. The defendant saying we intentionally shot at the lower part of the sedan to disable it, but not to hurt anyone, let alone kill someone. The Tenth Circuit found that the jury could nonetheless conclude that the defendant in Brown stabbed the victim intentionally, not to kill, but in a criminally negligent manner. This jury was so careful that it asked the court for a definition of the phrases caution and circumspection. And an agreement was made by all counsel in the court to provide that definition. So they were very careful. There's no question they listened closely to the judge's instructions. And it's very clear that the judge used the word self-defense or defending oneself in the instructions solely to identify the lawful act, which if committed in an unlawful manner or without due caution and circumspection could result in involuntary manslaughter. And that's exactly what happened here. Now, as to the false exculpatory statement, Mr. Dash incorrectly states that every case shows that it must be given only where there's a criminal investigation. There's not a single case he cites, there's no case on point, that rejects an effort by the government to provide this instruction where there's another sort of investigation. And as far as not knowing that this could result in a criminal prosecution, and we make this point in our briefs, the defendants, when they talked to the military investigator, signed waivers attached to their statements acknowledging that their statements could be used in a criminal trial. We believe the instruction was entirely proper, but if it wasn't, what really shows that it was harmless is that the jury gave credence to their statements that they were shooting at the lower part of the sedan in an effort only to disable it. They gave credence to it. So obviously, any error in giving the instruction, and again, we say there was none, was harmless, was absolutely harmless. And we'll stand on our brief on the Meacha issue. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Salisbury. All right, Mr. Dash, you have a few minutes.
Judge, with the court's permission, Mr. Kelleher would like to respond to the government's issues
about... I'll let one of you speak, either you or Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Kelleher, regarding...
Fine.
Your Honors, I would, in response to what Mr. Salisbury's comments, I would bring to the court's attention the very cases that Mr. Salisbury cited for the law on what's deadly force and when can it be a jury matter. Much has been made of the Brown case, both by the trial court and Mr. Salisbury, and by the defense. I would note that the Brown case itself indicates that the difference between involuntary and voluntary manslaughter, when you can get the instruction, is that you do not get it in involuntary where there's a wanton disregard for human life that is extreme in nature. And that is the same standard that is echoed in Crow and echoed in Manuel, which was a key basis for the court's decision. And in fact, in Manuel, the Ninth Circuit upheld the denial of the instruction precisely because they found that no rational jury could find involuntary manslaughter because the conduct was wanton and extremely reckless. And in that case, he didn't even use a gun. He essentially beat somebody to death with a tree stump. And yet the court recognized that when it is extreme in nature, then it is deadly force. Whether you claim you intended it or not, if it's also just recklessly extreme, then you don't get the instruction.
You do agree, don't you, or maybe you don't, that it makes a difference. There's no symmetry here. A court doesn't look at this exactly the same way when it's faced with the denial of an instruction on appeal by a defendant of a greater included offense in comparison here where the instruction is given and the defendant, you won't agree with this part, I know, but the defendant actually gets the benefit. I know, you don't see it that way. I get that. Because you think it was a jury compromise that if involuntary manslaughter were not in the case, your guy would have gotten a clean not guilty.
Right.
I'm not sure about that, but I understand the tactical consideration that goes into that. But my point simply is that, you know, what the Ninth Circuit says or the Tenth Circuit says in response to a defense appeal where the instruction's been denied doesn't tell us everything we need to know when we're reviewing a district judge's decision to give it with the government's request. And when you look at the facts and you draw the inferences in favor of the government, it looks like it was justified. Whether one of us would have given it, you know, whether any district judge would have given it is a different question.
Your Honor, my concern, I would submit that if one reads the instructions again from starting with self-defense through involuntary manslaughter, Mr. Salisbury is right that the jury looked at this very closely. They came back with questions about the definitions, and if I may finish, that essentially what the instruction is asking the jury to do is first find self-defense, then find due caution and circumspection, and it creates a circular loop where I would submit that what the jury... It's a confusing instruction that, at the very least, I think it ought to be vacated. And if the government really wants to try them on involuntary manslaughter, we'll do it for the third time. But it essentially creates a very confusing loop for the jury.
All right, thank you. Mr. Kelleher, do I understand you are court-appointed?
Yes, we're court-appointed.
Well, Mr. Dash is public
defender. Oh, I'm sorry, public defender. You're right. I
just wanted to recognize and thank you for your service in this case. And we'll... come down and greet counsel and take a short recess.
Honorable Court will take a brief recess.